Welcome to the Yanks Are Coming Soccer Show. I'm Carter Krishnire. He's Neil Blockman, and we're joined by a very special guest today, Jonathan Tannenwald, from the Philly Inquirer, and someone who I think everybody who follows the sport in this country, particularly the women's game, knows. So, Jonathan, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the kind words. I'm not sure that I'm much of a big deal, but I'll take your words.
Well, you've earned those words, Jonathan, so thank you again for everything you do. I'm going to lead off here, Neil, and ask Jonathan about the historic proportions of this World Cup win. We spent 4 months at this website and on our podcast, Neil and I, questioning certain aspects of the U.S.'s approach, questioning certain aspects of Jill Ellis' squad selection, tactically also. In the end, they ended up winning. So it's a historic feat to repeat as world champions. Germany did it, 2003 and 2007, but the women's game wasn't quite at the level it's at now at that point. So just walk us through what you think in terms of the history that this has made.
Look, I mean, and you guys alluded to it a minute ago, you cannot take this away from them at that point. You know, that they won the thing. For all the criticisms that all of us had going into the tournament, all the questions, all the pressure that we heaped on Jill Ellis and the players, they stood up to all of it and they won the thing. And, you know, it's not just that they won and repeated as champions, it's A, that it's something that the 99 team did not do. And, you know, when you look at the growth and the advancement of the women's game over the years, this was surely the toughest feat, the toughest World Cup to win overall, yet. And people will say, well, yes, they played Thailand and Chile, and that helped, and it certainly did. But, you know, one of the things that I think about, if you look at in aggregate, the whole of the teams they played, the U.S. played 5 of the top 15 teams in the FIFA rankings going into the tournament. This summer, and 4 years ago, even though the group stage is more difficult, they overall played only 4 of the top 15. And of course, they were next door in Canada. So,
and they didn't beat all of them, I should point out, because they didn't beat Sweden in that tournament, right?
That's right,
they did this time.
Sweden. Yeah. That's right. But so, you know, on the whole, in the end, they had a tougher course this time. And they won every game, and with the exception of the Spain game, they looked pretty darn good doing it. And, you know, as I've said to a number of people, yes, the France game was close. But if that third goal that was offside by the length of one of Crystal Dunn's big toes had gone in, sorry, had counted, it would have been 3-0, and that would have been the end.
Right, I would agree. The Spain game, and, you know, we've talked about this. The Spain game was really the most difficult test when you look back on it. I don't think there's much question about that. So, how do you assess Jill Ellis's job that she did in this tournament, Jonathan? Because I think, and Neil might want to follow up on this, but I think there were obviously a lot of question marks going into the tournament. On this show, people who listen to us regularly will know that I questioned particularly 2 omissions, Casey Short, because I wasn't sure Crystal Dunn could really play left back, and McCall Zerboni, because I felt like the U.S. midfield would be unbalanced without her potentially in that midfield. Granted, she has not had the best year with the Courage this year. She's not been at the level she was the last 2 seasons. But all of that aside, it seemed like a very unified group. Even if we could question matches where Lindsey Horan wasn't in the starting 11, it all came off well, and there didn't seem to be any strife in the camp, which I think not only winning the tournament, but the lack of strife in the camp, you have to give Jill Ellis some credit for.
Oh, I think that's definitely true, and I think it is something that people have been willing to give her credit for how she has managed the locker room. And this is, you know, we forget sometimes because the players are, for the most part, all very good people. We forget that it is not some inalienable right to have a team full of good people. there are a lot of different viewpoints on a lot of different subjects in that locker room that we never hear about.
Yeah.
But I just think that it was summed up for me in one very, very brief moment. Jordan is getting the exact quote right now. Jill Ellis was asked, this was the day before the USA-France quarterfinal, in which Jill Ellis and Megan Rapinoe were on the podium at the press conference, and we in the media all make too much sometimes of press conferences because it's the only access to the program we get. But you both have experience with college football, and you've seen the number of coaches who claim they won the press conference. I don't think I've ever, in all the events I've ever covered, seen a winning of the press conference quite like that one. I know it was broadcast on TV back here that day, perhaps, until you watched it. So Ellis was talking about the pressure that the U.S. team is under. While a couple of minutes earlier, Megan Rapinoe had made her statement about her remarks about President Trump and said that was all she was going to talk about. So Ellis is going on a completely different subject, and along the way said, there are elite people that live on a stage and they are always probably under scrutiny. I think this team has a remarkable focus. We all support Meg. She knows that. We know we have each other's backs in there. For our players, there's only one purpose, one mission that we're here for. Comments, media, whatever, it's always been something that I think we block out pretty easily. And on she went on that subject. Now, did you notice that she snuck in there, we all support Megan?
Yeah.
But she didn't dwell on it.
It was critical. Very deft.
Yeah.
It was a little bit subtle, but I guarantee you everyone in that locker room heard it last year.
So, I guess a question I have on, it's not even really on the kind of incredible scrutiny that it's under that was on Ellis really during the cycle, certainly after Rio. I think is a reflection of the differing expectation that is on the U.S. women, not just as representatives of the sport, which I know is something that all three of us have kind of talked about, that external burden, but just like the expectation for competitive excellence in and of itself, like in a vacuum. Ellis had been under such tremendous pressure, and now she's 13-0-1 in World Cup matches and a two-time World Cup champion. So I guess the question is, I mean, to you, what really defines, is the ability to manage that locker room, how central of that is that to her legacy in the sport of women's soccer, and kind of where does she situate now, whatever she decides to do, whether it's coach in 2020 or step aside after 2020 or, you know, stay as long as they'll have her?
Oh, I think it matters greatly. It's not everything. You know, I think even within the locker room there are questions about tactics. But she certainly now, you know, if 2015 did not give her the mandate to go to the veterans and say, hey, we can get there, I need your trust, which it didn't, as we know. Certainly now. And we have seen, and another example of sort of the subtle ways in which Ellis pushes the envelope that the three of us notice, but she does it in such a way that much of the public passes by it. She has made mention a number of times about the team needing to get younger.
Right.
And, you know, the need for diversifying the pathways to become an elite women's soccer player in the United States, which a lot of us agree with.
Yeah.
You know, including her critics. And we're still going to criticize her lineups and her roster selections. But it is fair to give her the credit for the things where the credit is due, and I think that's one of them. And, you know, I'll go back to Rapinoe for a second and take it a little bit broader. because this was in the news recently, as we know. And it is the Jaylene Hinkle question.
Yep.
Which, off the field, might be, and I can't think of everything off the top of my head, but I would say, without getting myself in too much hot water talking about politics, that the way that Ellis handled the Hinkle situation is probably one of the defining successes of her tenure off the field. There wasn't a lot of noise about it out of the U.S. locker room when it happened. There was obviously a lot of speculation, which didn't help anybody. And then, you know, Hinkle went on TV as she did and blew the lid off everything and off it went. Ellis, you know, called her back in. Last summer, the Tournament of Nations training camp, and then she didn't make the actual roster. And Ellis said it was all for soccer reasons, and if you believe that, I've got a bridge in Arizona to sell you. But Ellis was doing her job, and those of us who know the politics of the game well certainly understood that. And then that was that.
Right.
I can pretty well tell you, I mean, we know this, it's no secret. There are plenty of devout Christians in that locker room. But there is a way, as they do, to make sure that it gets left at the locker room door after a certain point, and prioritizing everybody getting along and winning Women's World Cup. And lo and behold, that's what they did. And I don't know Ashlyn Harris all that well. It would not surprise me. I don't know this. This is only my gut instinct talking. It would not surprise me if Ashlyn Harris went to a few of the rest of the team and said, hey, I think it's time to put this matter to bed once and for all. Because they had won the World Cup. They had won a World Cup in which they were shorted outside back. And even the critics of Hinkle's religious and social stances acknowledged that she played soccer fairly well. And the U.S. was shorted outside back, so she had to be discussed.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to, Jonathan, when you mentioned Jaylene Hinkle was. Because of that situation, and I think Jill Ellis, you're right, handled it perfectly, and we know the problems it would have caused in that dressing room if she had continued. A left back became this bugaboo. Maybe some of us in our minds, I include myself in this, overplayed the difficulty Ellis was going to have with Crystal Dunn, who of course plays with Jaylene Hinkle at the North Carolina Courage and plays in a more advanced role, and Jaylene Hinkle is the left back and is arguably the best left back in NWSL. I put Casey Short in that conversation also, who wasn't brought to this World Cup. But the way Ellis handled that decision about Hinkle and then sticking with Crystal Dunn, who had an outstanding World Cup, may well have won the tournament for the United States, and wanted to get your thoughts on the whole Crystal Dunn left back situation.
Well, I still don't think Crystal Dunn's a left back. I'm probably not going to think that Crystal Dunn's a left back, but she plays it well enough, that's for sure. And look, there were times, you know, I was at the U.S. France game in Paris, and I sat up there at the top of the stand in the press tribune, watching Kadira Diani, you know, race down the right wing untouched on a number of occasions. And I thought that was finally, each time I thought, oh, this is finally going to be the time when Crystal Dunn gets burned. And this is going to go in history books as, you know, the Chris Wondolowski moment for Jill Ellis when you missed land. I hate to do this, fellas, but I have to. when did they miss Landon Donovan? At the moment when they most needed him, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So when did they most miss a left back at the moment when they most needed one? And yet, every single time, Crystal Dunn, with her recovery speed, got back there and shut the guy down. And I thought that was really quite remarkable.
And also, Becky playing that side helped, I think, because of her veteran experience as a center back. Although she didn't have a great tournament either, but still.
They won the thing. At a certain point, all you could do was put your hands up and say they won the thing. And they they will lose at some point. I certainly thought as of, I don't know, June 25th or so, the odds were pretty good that the U.S. was going to lose in Tokyo next year. I've had to revise that a little bit because of the number of very good European teams that did not qualify for the Olympics.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I would say this, and it relates a bit to the young players and to Don and to a number of other people. You know, the pressure has been heaped on this program for 20 years to be role models, to win the World Cup at home in 1999, to repeat as champions, which they didn't, to win it back, which they didn't do in 2015, and then to repeat as champions this year. An immense amount of pressure on the program. Well-earned, they embraced it, they relished it, and so on. I would argue that for the first time in an awfully long time, and perhaps never, the pressure on this program is now lessened.
Mm.
And I'm probably going to write a column about this sometime next month, either around the Ireland game or the game in late August, which is a very hot rumor has it, is coming to Philadelphia. On August 29th, I heard, we are recording on Thursday. I heard on Wednesday of this week that Lincoln Financial Field is the favorite to get that game. And I heard it from enough sources that I felt compelled to put it out there in print. I think the pressure is off this program for the first time in a long time. Not off, as you can say, but lessened. There will certainly be expectations to win in Tokyo next year and do the double of being, going from the World Cup to winning the Olympics, which they've never done. I still believe it's still the case that nobody's ever done it, right?
Yeah.
Correct. The reigning Olympic champion has won the World Cup, but not the other way around.
Right, 12 and 15 for us would be the example for us. But yes, correct.
There will be some expectation as well, there should be. But by the time you get to 2023, assuming that tournament is going to be in Australia or Japan, we don't know yet, but the assumption seems relatively safe. Assuming that, and with the distinct possibility that 2027 is going to be in the United States. Now, Carlos Cordero made part of his presidential election platform not just winning the 26 bid, but bidding for 27. And you'd think that they'd be at the front of the line to get it for reasons that we can discuss. If 27 is going to be here, you're going to a World Cup in 23 where all the games are going to be at 2 in the morning and not a lot of American fans can go. The pressure is lessened, isn't it?
Yeah, it was lessened in 2007 even, based on that, the time of the and 2008 Olympics. Although I think after 7, we had to bounce back in the 8 Olympics. But the time difference, Jonathan, at least in 2007, yeah, that is a good point. Because I think we had greater pressure in 3 and 11, 3 to repeat, 11 to win it back, than we did in 7. Now, of course, Hope Solo blew up that whole thing in 7. But that's a great point. I never thought about the time zone thing.
And it, you know, if 27 does go somewhere else, then it changes the calculus.
Right.
If it comes here, then you can play a little more toward that than you might otherwise. And, you know, you'd have the 24 Olympics in Paris as sort of a bounce back from 23 and start the move toward 27 and then 28 in Los Angeles. And if they don't do the double next year, then you'd certainly, you know, all the doors are open to put all the pressure in the world on them to do the double in 27 and 28 on home soil, as well there should be. But it's certainly there as a possibility, I think, and it would allow the U.S. to do some long-term planning in a way that they really have very rarely ever been able to do, I would say.
How much, you wrote a column that was syndicated because I got to end up reading it in Chicago. So, but the column you wrote was after the win, was noting that, you know, that there's this chance of equal pay after the final. And, you know,
I have to go look that up if I've actually landed in one of the Chicago papers.
Chicago Tribune, I get to read it. And one paragraph that stuck out to me was at the end, you wrote, from the equal pay chance that rained down in Lyon to the roars that rose up from bars across the country, there's been more than enough noise to prove consumer demand is for women's soccer. Time has come to meet it. Is that the cultural legacy of this team? Because I think it's been one mistake I've seen. It's this idea that this team doesn't sort of occupy a cultural moment, that they might be the greatest women's team ever assembled, but that's sort of their legacy, as opposed to the 99ers, who occupied and sort of seized the cultural moment. Maybe this team has that because, and maybe that has something to do with how expectations are lower, just in the sense of, you know, they have so many people that have received and now kind of joined them in that equal pay advocacy, if that makes sense.
Well, it's an interesting question. My inclination is this, and look, obviously I've been banging the drum for a long time. You know, all 16 years I've been banging the drum in various forms about treating women's soccer as soccer and treating its commercial potential as that.
Yep.
You know, the time was and remains, frankly. It's better now than it used to be. But certainly in the days of WUSA and WPS, if you wanted to buy a jersey, good luck. And, you know, I felt that in 2015, you know, the television ratings showed that there was interest in the U.S. women's soccer team.
With games in prime time.
Correct.
Right.
That there was suitable and notable interest, really, and a fan base for this team. And I felt in watching the sports growth in the 4 years since then, I felt that this would be the year that would prove that not only was there interest, but you could actually make some money off it.
Right.
And that applied not just to the domestic audience here, but to the rest of the world, especially in Western Europe, where the game has advanced so much. And I think it got proven. I really do. And, you know, the drumbeat certainly got a little louder, and I wasn't the only one, you know, making the noise. But I think we really did see something.
So let's.
And,
oh, sorry.
You know, we'll see if it keeps going.
Let's transition to NWSL. That's a great segue, Jonathan. The league, I feel like we've gotten more out of this league than we got out of WUSA or WPS. But there's still the lingering questions about club soccer, the women's game, longevity, its ability to self-sustain, all of those things. However, and we also have, and we'll get to Sky Blue, I'm sure, before we're done today. And we have, you know, some low-hanging fruit also as in terms of legacy clubs. But I get the sense, and we've had one game on ESPN News, the story you broke during the World Cup that NWSL would have matches on ESPN platforms for the rest of the season. With a decent number, 77,000, without, you know, Sinclair was playing, Marta was playing, but no U.S. players. Do you think maybe we're going to see the rest of this year, the next 3 months, for the remainder of the NWSL season, a knock-on effect? Because certainly, obviously, we're all hoping for that. I'm seeing some initial signs. The rain looked like they've sold out their homecoming match from Rapino, et cetera, this weekend in Tacoma. Do you think we're going to see that knock-on effect, and where does NWSL go beyond that?
Well, the
You hope so. I think there's been a much more concentrated effort this year to drive people to the NWSL. Unfortunately, it has not really been done by the league itself. And the league's lack of a marketing staff right now is a big problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Budweiser deal was arguably bigger than the ESPN deal. They were always going to do a TV deal of some kind. But the... and I will say this about ESPN. I know a lot of people wanted them to go to NBC because they felt like NBC would do a better job of promoting it. That or they just wanted to have Premier League and WSL doubleheaders for their own volition. I don't know. But I got the impression from ESPN last year, never mind, and have for some time, that they have been saying to the NWSL, hello, we're right here. Pick up the phone and call us. And, you know, the sorts of people who have an interest in that are no secret, because Amy Rosenfeld, who I believe you two both know, who at this point is not in the currently sort of overseeing all of the soccer because she's been involved in the launch of the ACC network, but she is there and still is paying attention, you know, has been involved in the women's game since the 90s. You know, she was ABC's lead coordinating producer in 99. So, you know, again, the message from ESPN all along has been, we're right here. And now that is where they're going to be. And the hope among some of us is where they're going to take the whole suite next year, because a fair few of us have been waiting for the day when MLS, the USL, and the NWSL are on the same platform. And that is us in the rest of the country, and I know some people in Bristol who believe the same, and there are plenty of indications that the talks are going on to make it happen. The Budweiser deal is the big one.
Even if announced at 2 a.m.
Yeah, on the TV.
Well, and I think we figured out why that happened.
Right.
But I think that, it doesn't mean I would have done it that way, I'm just saying, I think we know why it happened.
Yeah.
I think that it's a big deal for a number of reasons. One, it's a marquee corporate sponsorship. And two, it's a product that you have to be 21 years old to consume. That matters because we have for so long heard about how soccer is supported the young girls in the country. And a few of us have believed that it need not be just that. So here's some proof. And I'm writing a piece this week and early next. Where the NWSL goes from here piece, in which that is one of the central...
Jonathan, I wanted to ask you about the getting the A&E equity bought back, because while it put the league a step back on television for half a season, my understanding from talking to people on background, and I'm not going to mention anyone publicly, is that that was a big step in pivoting NWSL toward better health in the future. You have an expertise in this, so what's your thought on that situation?
I think that's right. I've heard the same thing. And from the people who I talked to at the time the deal got done, you know, the consensus was, well, and then the burden gets put on the people who took the burden on, as it were, to get the commercial deal done and so on. And the response I got back was, yes, we're going to do it. And initially there wasn't much proof, and now there is a bit of proof. I understand. I have not put this down in writing yet, but it will be in the story, I think, that I'm going to write, and I'll divulge it here. I understand that Soccer United Marketing did that Budweiser deal. We know that much, but I understand that they did it effectively pro bono. And you might say, well, what is pro bono in the context of some relationship with the U.S. Soccer Federation? And that's fair. But certainly the impression was they didn't have to do this, and they did it. Because they do, in fact, care, and they do want to help. Now, whether that translates into something longer term, after... I don't know whether it's this year or whatever period of time is when the when the current arrangement expires, we'll find out. You know, if you're the league, if you're the NWSL, do you try to, you know, book something with some for, you know, 3 years or so, which gets you to 2022, at the end of which, you know, Major League Soccer's primary rights deal with Fox ESPN and Univision expires, and then you try to do something to finally unify the whole house? I think that's, you know, that's how I'd do it. But at the same time, don't want to, you don't want to have that structured in such a way that it limits the ability of new capital and new and different ownerships to come into the picture. And that's going to be a very interesting balance to try to strike.
And that goes back to the A&E deal, what that might have been inhibiting perhaps some nimbleness from NWSL. So that's definitely a something to consider. Neil, do we want to get into the Sky Blue issue now with Jonathan, or do we want to save that for the very end?
No, I thought we'd save that. You know, because I wanted to circle back on this idea of, like, because, you know, everybody talks about the springboard from the World Cup and how that relates to growing NWSL. But, I, you know, Jonathan was in France, and I kind of wanted to get his impression about, because people are skeptical about listening to FIFA, but you had the Infantino comments about, oh, there was a before the World Cup and there will be an after. We need to make sure we do something with this opportunity. And obviously, anytime FIFA makes promises about women's football, there's going to be skepticism about that, to say the least. But we also saw, because we have these host of NWSL challenges at home, I think sometimes I guess the question is, we saw the reception that Argentina had when they got home. We saw...
There was a reception.
We saw... Yeah, well, then let's just start it there being a reception. We saw the way that a team that was a debutante in 2015 was a World Cup finalist in 2019, but not just a World Cup finalist, one with arguably the largest following on the ground in France, other than maybe the host, depending on where you were.
And the U.S., I would say. The U.S.
Yeah. Yep.
The Dutch certainly were the biggest among everybody else.
Yeah. And, I mean, so we saw this. What benefit, you know, what type of, you know, and maybe there's something to be gleaned from the way that the game has grown in Europe at home with the NWSL. But I guess that, you know, what did you see in France that you think, you know, is instructive about how the 2019 World Cup can help continue to grow the game globally, where 2023 is the most competitive World Cup?
Well, it certainly resonated a lot in Europe and in the big European nations, England, Germany, the Netherlands, even Spain and Italy. I mean, Italy's run and the attention that they got and the success that they had, I thought, was one of the great stories of the entire World Cup. I'm a little biased because I wrote the story about them. But, you know, it was terrific to see. And even then, you know, there you could get the Gazette de la Sport in Paris and a few other places around the country at some of the newsstands, and even then it was barely the top story in the morning, despite the huge television audiences, because the games were on RAI, I believe for the first time. There was a lot of progress and a lot of interest in capitalizing on that progress and a lot of interest in monetizing that progress, and we have seen that the major clubs in Europe, who are the drivers of a lot of money, have stepped up now and said, hey, let's do this. And let's see now, as we go forward, what it comes to and how that changes the game even further. Hopefully puts a little more money into the Women's Champions League. And because, look, this is going to sound very cliche, but it's true. If there's a Juventus-Bayern Munich game in the Champions League, then people pay attention. And when there's a Manchester City, Manchester United game to start the English season, people pay attention, and Man City has decided, Cardiff, as you know very well, they're going to play that game in the Etihad Stadium.
Yep.
And let's see how big a crowd they get.
It's September 7th for those out there who are looking forward to it. It's going to be a tremendous occasion, particularly given the core of the English team that did so well in this tournament. Are tied to Man City, have been with Nick Kucinich's team in the past or currently. So really looking forward to that. Jonathan, on that score, do you think NWSL will be able to keep the Sam Kerrs of the world in the league beyond this year with increased competition from European clubs?
Well, it's a big question, and it's one that I would like to ask Amanda Duffy, and I'm going to have the opportunity to a few days after I'm on this show. Part of the aforementioned story that I'm writing about the NWSL's future, that the Duffy interview is coming down the pike for me. Okay. Now, one of the questions that I have is the NWSL ready for a designated player rule? And I might get back the answer, not yet. The management doesn't always want to spend money on the waiver salary, so it won't surprise me if the answer is not yet. But nonetheless, I think that one is, I've said this a bunch, you guys know. See me say it. I think a designated player rule is in order for this league. Not only to keep Sam Kerr, but to maybe take a swing at a few of the other players who are out there and bring a little more international spice to the table. We know that a lot of the international players want to at least take a shot at playing in the NWSL because they see how competitive it is across the board. They'd like to perhaps to live in America for a bit. I mentioned the competitive aspect. That's probably the biggest part of it because we know that in the European League, there are, for the most part, two or three big teams in each league, and then the rest of it isn't really competitive. So I think we're getting to the point where it can be sustainable and would help, especially if, a couple of new expansion teams with some deep pockets come in, and we'll see what happens. Would it keep Kerr? I don't know. Kerr's a different one a little bit in some ways because she, the way things are set up, she's able to play at home in Australia, not only in the NWSL because of the way that the seasons overlap. So we'll find out. But I look around some of the teams in Europe. I look at, Vivian Niedema, for example. If Arsenal has some money, but wouldn't you want to try to tempt her over for a year if you could, or a Lika Martins or a Shanice Van de Sanden? I've said Amadine Henry came over to Portland for a bit and really liked it, and I'm sure that message got around to her French teammates. I have said for years that I would like to see Wendy Renard in this league. I think she'd be a star. And you are a Portland or a North Carolina or an expansion team in Los Angeles or perhaps down the road Atlanta, dare we say. Do you load up the brakes truck and try to get Etta Hegerberg over here for a year and see if you can?
Wow. Wow. That'd be something.
Well, look, if I can't say that I know how it would work in terms of what the salaries would be, but, we know that the U.S. and Canadian national team players get, they get much more money than the rest. And they get more money than international players, too, which inhibits the ability to get international players over here who are of consequence who are going to make a lot more money in Europe.
Yeah, and the one exception to that is the Australian players, because I've had a conversation with one of their national team players, not named Sam Kerr, who plays in in our league, so you could, by process of elimination, figure out maybe who that might be, who told me privately, if not for getting the A-League salary, she would not be in NWSL. So being able to play in both leagues is critical, but other than Australian players, you really don't have that situation, so you lose out on those international stars outside of Australian players.
Right, so, and there's really only... But who's the other big one? It's Marta, and Marta's the case unto herself in a lot of ways, as you know. But if you want to go and try to get the European bigger names who will raise the quality of the league, I think a designated player will, you know, I think the time is coming. And, you know, if they structure it right, and if we'll say it, if they structure it akin to MLS, where the league is going to be on the hook for some amount of money, and then the owner has the ability to go take a swing if they want to. Why not at least try to get Hegerberg or somebody of that ilk, you know?
Yeah. I mean, or when I saw Japan, I mean, Yuka Momiki is American.
Yeah.
And we all saw how good she is and, you know, was asked, you know, because Nippon has a lot of money. But, you know,
right.
would you go to America? Yeah, I'd go to Portland. I'd go to Seattle. Why wouldn't I play, you know, in a place like that? But financially, it would have to be worth it to her. And maybe you could lure Yui Hasegawa, or, you know. So I think that there's, you know, like you pointed out, Jonathan, obviously contingent on market, but why wouldn't you if you had that capability and flexibility? And that's probably your pathway to sustaining the elite kind of competitiveness of the league, which really, you know, is the distinction. You know, people ask, would Lyon win the NWSL? Probably, but they'd also, you know, have to play good teams a lot more.
Yeah.
Well, I think they would, but I flipped the question on its head. I know we were talking about Sky Blue at some point, and maybe this will end up being the entree to it. Lyon would win the NWSL. Where would Sky Blue finish in Ligue 1?
Yeah.
They'd win more games than they're winning here. Would be
that's
my
right.
answer. Yeah, that would
that's
be
right.
absolutely
they've been
my
higher than people think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, Jonathan, maybe segueing toward the Sky Blue issue, which Neil knows I've been hankering to talk about with you. If we have a DP rule, what would be the pushback on that? I know there is concern that, well, Merrick Paulson in Portland, Steve Malik in North Carolina, maybe one or two other teams, the Reigns seem a little more ambitious now. Would they end up spending in a way that makes the Sky Blues and Red Stars, et cetera, Washington-type teams, completely non-competitive? Or would it be one of these things where a rising tide lifts all boats? Or are we getting to the point where we have to deal, Boston faded away? Are we at a point where we're going to have to deal with Chicago, Washington, Sky Blue sooner or later?
I'm going to exempt the Red Stars from that conversation, believe it or not, because I think they're actually closer to the ring in that regard. Arnim Whistler's pretty good about this stuff. I'm not saying it's perfect.
Yeah.
But I think he'd be... I suspect that he would vote for a DP rule.
Okay.
But Washington and Sky Blue are certainly in the spotlight there. Washington has new ownership that is starting to push the boat out a bit, and we'll see how that manifests itself. If it gets more than two games a year into Audi Field, it will certainly be helpful. DC United has no mandate to charge them cheap rent, but they might get a little pressure to do so. It wouldn't hurt. Sky Blue is the interesting one. And I know Elise LeHue, who's their general manager, pretty well. I don't know the ownership. I've encountered the ownership on occasion. Some of my colleagues encounter the ownership far more than I do because they work at the State House in Trenton. I really don't know what's going to happen there, other than that it is my understanding, and I believe this has been reported elsewhere, that they have to leave USAC Field at the end of the year by U.S. Soccer Federation rule, because that venue does not meet the standards, and they are out of exemptions. And I know that the Leaves League is working on it, but there are not all that many options, if we are honest. And it's going to be a major challenge.
And they're going to have to stay in Jersey, obviously. Or try and stay in Jersey. Well, okay, that's a question.
Well, and I think it's a legitimate question as to whether they are going to have to stay in Jersey. You know, they have a fan base there. Is it so enormous that it would be very, very deeply missed if they crossed the Hudson? Or cross Delaware going the other direction? I know some of them. I've had the conversation with them, and I think that I can say that they are realistic about it. And you guys know that I have said for some time now that I think the ideal ownership group for Sky Blue FC is City Football.
Yeah.
Not the Red Bulls.
Right.
If the Red Bulls want it, sure. But they had their opportunity. Obviously, Sky Blue pushed back and did not take it because they were the owners and management at the time were short-sighted and a bit small-minded, didn't want to cede their power, which was a mistake. We don't know what the Red Bulls think now, but we do know that City Football Group is making a big investment in the women's game. And if they have an interest, given the connections that they have, and they put the call in and they offer to write a check, if I'm the NWSL, there is going to be some backlash. I don't know how much backlash there's going to be. I am not an expert in that. I will defer to those who are. But I suspect that on the whole, the good would outweigh the bad. And if you put the women's team at Columbia University for a few years at their football stadium, which I believe seats around 10,000-12,000 people, play there for a couple years, and then you go over to the New York City Council and you say, hey, we are not just a bunch of rich, white, and foreign men. We are here doing a women's team. Our community service work in the city of New York is real and substantial, and that is true. We all know that it's true.
Right.
And it is not just about boys. We are doing it about girls, too, which they are, and which they would even extend further, I think, having a women's team. Let's sit down and get a stadium built.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think that would help?
Yes. I had not thought about that until this very moment, Jonathan. I think you're onto something.
It's a really good point.
Yeah,
that's a really good point.
I'm kind of blown away by that point, actually, because that could be a game changer for New York City FC in getting done what they cannot get done in the city currently.
But it just seems to me like that whatever the ownership situation is with Sky Blue is more important than maybe on-field competitiveness compared to, say, Orlando in our neck of the woods. Where, you know, I know that there's a good soccer circle group of people that say this is a team that should be actively trying to sell Alex Morgan.
It's a team that could have had Lindsey Horan and Emily Sonnet if they had not wanted Alex Morgan, but that's a sort of thing. I will not belabor that point.
But no, I think it's an important distinction to draw because, you know, in and around Orlando soccer culture, I'm not really sure that they're ready to do that. Like, Would winning more games be more valuable to the Orlando Pride than having Alex Morgan with the club?
Well, they made that decision they made that decision when they had the rights to Lindsey Horan. She was coming back to this league. They had the chance to draft Emily Sonnet. They made that decision 4 years ago.
But now they get a chance to revisit that decision. The point. And so, you know, that's a conversation that's being, those two teams are playing Saturday. So that's a conversation that's being had right now. And, you know, I don't think Alex would be, you know, between you, me, and anyone that probably follows this closely would be particularly reluctant to leave.
I have many views about Orlando.
As we all do.
As we all do. That's correct.
It's the right podcast for that.
Yeah.
A lot of the views that we have are the same views, aren't they? they reflect upon the organization as a whole, I would say, and not just the Pride, and some of the flaws afflict the men's team too, and afflict a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say this. The attendance or lack thereof at Pride games has been a concern for some time, and after a point, I think you have to point the things at the fans as much as you do the team.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because when they're right there in front of you, sometimes if they're right there in front of you, the incumbency is upon the fans to walk over the stadium and go buy a ticket.
So, Jonathan, going forward on teams like Orlando and Houston in particular, connected to MLS clubs, but clearly treated as – they're not treated the way Portland is, okay? They're not marketed the same way. When do we put the onus on the owners, or when – and at what point do we put, say, as you just said, maybe the fan bases in those sorts of markets are not – mature enough or sophisticated enough for this product? When do we make that call, or how do we make that call?
I don't have an easy answer to that. So I might pass on it.
Yeah.
Because I don't know enough about the situation down there.
Right. Because what we've seen in North Carolina is that connecting the Courage to a men's team. Now, granted, the Courage are a lot more successful than the Pride and have been run and they have Paul Riley as their manager, which is a great thing. But we've seen it work there. We've seen connecting the men's and women's team work there, at least in my opinion. So it can work. But maybe it's down to the ownership. Maybe it's down to the market.
I think there's some of that. It's not a market that I know a ton about. And the fact that, although it's funny, the thing that I know the most about in Orlando, I mean, I know a few people who work at the team, but the newspaper down there is one that I have a lot of connections to. And there's not a better paper in the country in terms of getting the word out about the local soccer teams.
Yeah. Nope, there really isn't.
Dude, absolutely the best, I agree.
And two of our sports better writers I don't want to say their time, but Orlando was privileged to have them cover, and Paul and Alicia. So,
yeah,
and Jordan.
I don't accept the owners, and I don't accept the fans. I guess.
Let me leave Jonathan with this question. This is more of a legacy back to the USWNT, but connected to Sky Blue. You know, what's the Carly Lloyd legacy in terms of, is it to you, is it where Mia, is it where Abby is, is it she was, you know, a willing teammate and former full-time captain this summer? I mean, is that a huge part of it and still willingly accepted the role that Jill gave her?
I'm not sure how much of it willingly, but yeah, sure.
Well, we all know she wasn't pleased with it, but managed to you know, still impact winning. And you know, do you think that she looks at that role and looks at 2020 in Tokyo and says, I don't know? Where do you think she's at on that? And maybe the broader question, the better question, is the one about where her legacy is.
Her legacy. Well, let's start with her legacy, because her legacy is immense. Two times a World Cup winner, you know, multiple Olympic gold medals,
of a generation of U.S. national team players who earned and used the ability to dictate where they played. First Man City and then Sky Blue. One of the most driven athletes I have ever met, Naylor.
Yeah. We can all attest to
that. And, you know, we all know, it is no secret, it's been there for a long time, that Roy has never been one for the social, being at the front of the line on the social justice and so on. She wanted to be the best soccer player in the world. Nothing more, nothing less. And she got there.
Yep.
And then the peak came, and then came the descent from it over the last couple of years. And she is very proud, and she has an ego, as we know. But she got there. And no one can take that away from her, even her critics. And she worked immensely hard when Jill Ellis said, look, we need a different kind of player in the attacking midfield position. I see your goal-scoring instincts, and I want to make you a forward. And Lloyd did the work and succeeded. And we know that, you know, there were certain points in time when, in the midst of Alex Morgan's goal drought at the World Cup, when a lot of people called for Lloyd to play, and I said, not so fast, not because of Lloyd's quality. This is just a different kind of player,
right,
than Morgan. And a lot of people did not take in the full suite of what Morgan brought to the field. But Lloyd scored some significant goals in this tournament, as we know, and earned the right to celebrate them. And, you know, now comes, and I was the one thinking, by the way, she was the one who was there right there in the middle of the podium lifting the World Cup trophy with Morgan and Rapinoe, because there is the understanding in that locker room of Lloyd's experience and leadership and what that means.
Right.
Now what is the question?
And
we know... Go ahead, Carter.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you, part of her legacy, in my opinion, is that here is someone who at 18, 19, 20 wasn't one of these wonder kids tapped for the national team. She wasn't getting caps. She played through at Rutgers, elevated her game, finally worked her way into the national team, reinvented herself several times, and was a two-time world champion, was instrumental in one of those championships, was the best player in the world at that point, and two gold medals. Does she set an example, in your opinion, Jonathan, having covered her more closely than just about anyone, for the rest of the girls in that locker room, the rest of the players, the rest of the women, and particularly the younger women who are coming through similar situations where they may have played college soccer, they may not have been as fancied as the person next to them for national team selection?
I think so. I suspect that the more prominent examples in that regard are going to be Lindsey Horan and Mal Pugh, who bypassed college entirely.
Yes. Yeah.
By the time all is said and done. But sure, absolutely. And certainly, you know, I'll take it local to my interests for a second. She has inspired a heck of a lot of young girls, young female soccer players in the field years. No doubt about that. And that is a legacy that will live on for a very long time. I mentioned, though, what next? And it's going to become very interesting, I think, very quickly.
That's pretty exciting this week. So, not a lot of time between 2019 Victory Tour in Tokyo either.
Well, here's the thing. You look at the 23 players on the U.S. World Cup roster. You have to get from 23 at the World Cup to 18 for the Olympics.
Yeah.
So it's relatively easy. French, Krieger, Long, Brian, McDonald, that's five. Right there. Now, what happens if you want to bring somebody else in? Such as an Andy Sullivan. Then what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where the rubber might hit the road in terms of some very difficult discussions. And I just think that it is going to be unavoidable that the first name that will come up is going to be Lloyd's.
Even though at this point, Jonathan, if we picked an 18 now for Summer Olympics, she'd be in that 18.
Correct.
She'd be on the fringe of it, but she'd be in it.
Right. The question is, do you want to bring in an Andy Sullivan or somebody else who did not go to the World Cup? And if so, who do you drop?
Yeah.
And I think that Lloyd is going to be, have to be, at the top of that list out of necessity, because the three major veterans are Lloyd, Rapinoe, and Sullivan. I don't think, and you know, obviously this assumes nobody gets injured, but if Rapinoe retires, it's an almighty loss. But I'm not sure. I don't know that. I don't know that you want to give that up just yet. Sauerbrunn obviously is not going to go anywhere just yet.
And if they cannot win a gold medal,
play the crucial role tactically.
Yeah, you can't win without Becky on the back line, my opinion right now.
Not yet.
From a pure tactical perspective, 90 minutes on the field, formation, etc., exclusive of the locker room, leadership skills, anything else, purely from a tactical perspective, can Lloyd's contribution be omitted when you cut from 23 to 18 if you want to bring somebody else in? I think it's possible.
Yeah.
It's tough.
That's a tough question.
And she hasn't talked to me in about 3.5 months, deliberately. I've mentioned this to a few people. She put me on her blacklist for reasons that I was never quite able to discern. I asked around some people who would know and came back, well, you probably wrote something that you disagreed with. To which I said, fine, that's all right. I'd just like to know if I wrote something inaccurate. I never found out. The word finally got to me that, hey, you probably, you wrote something that she disagreed with. She used it as a chip on her shoulder. She's not talking to you. Fine. To which my response was, fine, that's her right. Went on from there. I guess I'm next going to see her in August because I'm going to miss Sky Blue's first home game when she comes back. I have another obligation that night. It's a big question, and it's going to be time to answer it soon enough. And I don't envy Jill Ellis for having to have those conversations.
Whew. Well, that's a perfect place to end. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time and your expertise and your continued coverage of
this work.
It's a pleasure, fellas, anytime. Thank you for the good work that you guys do. And I'm sure we'll talk again soon enough.